Great works did I do, building houses aspree, also vineyards and gardens and parks with fruit tree. I made pools of water to irrigate well the forest wherein many trees came to dwell. That was from Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verses 5 and 6, little children, from the Ward Green version of 2020. And we now resume, that was our daily scripture for today, but we now resume our study of the Ark of Urartu article. We've been encountering some interesting ideas. The beam widths we talked about on the boat, right? And the 138, it was the beam width, but what I was not understanding was that the beam width was obtained by multiplying by phi. So when the later on, I believe Mr. Windsor talks about dividing by phi and dividing again by phi to obtain the depth. The height of the ark, and because the beam widths. So he said, but he said, wait a minute now. If we divide 138 by phi, what do we get? Let's see. Yeah, but the idea is, we're only really dividing the number, right. I mean, math is always kind of tricky, right? But let's say you take 50 divided by 1.6 or whatever. What are you going to get? 30, approximately 30? Yeah, you get about 30. So that's the depth of the arc. So you're dividing the width by phi, in other words, right? Whereas if you start with 138 in feet, that was obtained by multiplying by phi. Right, because it's the beam width, not the average width. So this is the thing I was trying to explain why I wanted to say that the 138 was not the beam width in the sense that I thought it was before, but it is the beam width. It's the widest point of the boat. But if we divide by 1.6, well, let's make it more accurate, 1.618 squared, because we're going to square it. We might as well have it accurate. If we divide that, we get 50, you see? And that's feet, not cubits. So the Egyptian cubit, I want to talk about that today too, but 50 feet times 20.6 inches and divided by 12 should give us, what is that, times inches... that would have applied if it was 50 cubits. That's right. So we had 130. Let's do that again. 138. And let's not make the mistake of losing our record here. So we say it's about 50 feet. When we divide by phi squared. That's the depth of the boat, 52. But what I want to do is get that number into cubits instead of feet, right? So to do that, we have to divide by the number of feet in a cubit, which is the number of inches in a cubit, 20.6 divided by 12. I think that's the way I should have been doing it. I think that's right. Yeah, and we get 30. That's right. Okay. So you see how it works out that you divide the 138 by phi squared because 138 was created by multiplying by phi. So that's why it ended up having a phi squared factor in working out the height of the arc in cubits, right? As 30, when Mr. Windsor was talking about it, he mentioned this division by phi squared, if I recall. But somewhere I saw that it must have been Mr. Windsor because he's the only one who talks about it. But both the Septuagint Bible and the Hebrew Bible. What else did I want to talk about again? Oh, yeah, well, let's see now. What else did I want to mention again that we talked about yesterday? Yeah, I mean, it's very... I know, the Egyptian cubit. Yeah, I wanted to talk about the Egyptian cubit. If you look at Wikipedia right now, I saw this, the royal cubit. The royal cubit, it was given here as 20... see now. These rods, cubit rods, two of which are known from the tomb of Maya, who was a treasurer during the time of Tutankhamun. And that, he's a well-known king of Egypt, as I think most people know. But 14 rods were described by Lepsius, and one, okay, they ranged from 20 5/8 to a little bit bigger in inches, okay? 20 5/8 is 20.625, so 20.6 is a really good number that we got using the measurements on the ark itself, using the 515 measured length of the ark relic on the Drupanar site on the mountain there, in the mountains of Ararat. And that 515 was used to determine the Egyptian cubit, because in the Bible it says 300 cubits was the length of the ark, and Moses was an Egyptian, so we divide by 20.6, or we could have divided by 20.6, but we divided by 300, the 515 feet, right? We said, well, divide by, get it into inches, first of all, or whatever, and divide by 300, and we got, well, let's do it again. Let's do it again. Because people who don't do a lot of math probably don't remember this. 515 divided by, or first of all, no, first of all, times, that's feet. So multiply by 12, it's now in inches. Divide by the 300 units of cubits that were in the Bible for the length in cubits. That means 20.6 inches per cubit is the number, which compares very favorably to the 20 5/8 known for the ancient Egyptian royal cubit. And the Bible says that Moses was raised in the royal household of Pharaoh, right? So for him to have used the royal cubit in his records that we find in the Bible, Genesis, the first five books, actually, of the Bible were written by Moses. So for us to find the Egyptian cubit is perfectly consistent. Everything fits really well. I just wanted to help verify that. But both the Septuagint Bible, Sir Lancelot C.L. Brenton wrote, or that was his translation that I'm referring to, and the Hebrew Bible, both the Septuagint, which is Greek, and the Hebrew, which is another language entirely, but they're both translations of the Bible, and they both agree that after 5 months or 150 days on the 27th or the 17th day of the 7th month, respectively, depending on which version, and we explain that in some other later articles as to why that discrepancy or why it's there or how it can be explained. We're not going to go into that today, I don't think. That's too complex right now to worry about. But the ark came to rest on the mountains of RRT, which means Ararat or Urartu. If you notice, the RRT is present in both of those names, and the vowels are considered to be irrelevant, right? So just the consonants, RRT spells Ararat or Urartu, and it's perhaps related to Hurite, Hurite being If you ignore the H, again, it's just RRT for the consonants. H just being an aspiration sound that occurs at the beginning of words that begin with a vowel. So it could be urite, but pronounced hurite. And it's just got the RRT again. The vowels, of course, as I mentioned, did not exist in any of the original Hebrew text. They were added later by Masoretic. The Masoretes, or the Masoretic scribes, much after the time of Jesus in the Hebrew. But of course, we have good reason to understand that Jesus and his disciples used the Greek Septuagint. And Greek was a common language in the time of the Lord, Jesus. As the ancient Hebrew writing, talking about these vowels in the Hebrew text, as it was an abjad, it didn't have vowels, the importance of the vowels is really negligible. We don't have to worry about that. It's just the consonants that matter, because the ancient Hebrew was a consonantal language. It only had consonants. In this region, southeast of the Black Sea, is where Urartu or Bienili, or the kingdom of Van or Ararat, was located. In ancient times, around 860 to 590 BCE, and notice that the BCE years count backwards, and BCE is before the Common Era, of course, before the time of Christ, in other words, and that's given from Wikipedia with regard to the dating of this kingdom of Urartu. The name Urartu is also found in Assyria, about 1250 BCE, what is present-day eastern Turkey in the area of Lake Van, is near where Urartu lay, near today's country of Armenia. Noah's Ark is in Turkey. This relic near Iran is where the Ark lies, 35 miles southwest of Armenia. It is 2 miles north of Iran and 45 miles south of Armenia, if you go straight north, you know, or straight, yeah, to get to Armenia. It's a little longer than going to the southwest from Armenia to get to the Ark, you know. The border is such that it's 35 miles southwest of Armenia, the Ark is, and 45 miles south of Armenia. The similarity of Ararat to Arata, that's right, very similar to Arata, isn't it? In the story of the post-diluvian, or in other words, post flood ruler Enmerkar, echoes the story of Haik, the Armenian patriarchal founder who kills Bel, a Babylonian. I think we're going to read more about him in this article later. The location of the mountain where the Ark landed is from Berosus, the, quote, mountain of the Chordeans, end quote, as we saw recently, or as locals around Uzengili call it, Kudidagi, Judidagi. Actually, it's pronounced Judy in Turkish, Judidagi. So Mount Judy, Dagi means mountain. But in the Kurdish mountains is where it's located, the Chordeans, the Kurds, and the similarity of those names also to Ararat. The Chordeans, if the K is just an aspiration sound, it's just like Erds, Herds or Kurds. And if it's Erds, it's like Ararat, because it's just the R and D, with D being close. What do we want to call that? A close relative of the letter T. So R and D are like R and T. So it's very similar again to Ararat, the word Kurd. But while the Quran at 1144 says, quote, it came to rest upon the Mount Judy, end quote. On this point, the Epic of Gilgamesh asserts on Mount Nisir. That's a different language, because that's the Sumerian language, the Epic of Gilgamesh, compared to the Quran, which is Arabic. So in the Sumerian, it says, on Mount Nisir, the ship stuck fast, and it did not slip away. So all of these evidences show that this is the mountain where the ark landed, was Mount Judy, or Mount Nisir, and the name of the city that developed around the ark site at the top of the mountain was later called Naqshbandiyya, which is similar to Nisir also, I suppose. Naqshbandiyya, N-A-X-U-A-N. So I think we should go, and because we missed our video yesterday, maybe we can see it today, or maybe not. I don't know. I haven't looked at it yet. Let's see if we can see this video if we go over to where we left off 2 days ago, somewhere around here. Let's maximize it also. Let's see what we got here. Yeah.
In the logs and are kept in place with rope. They act as a sort of keel as well as a rudder and assist the raft in moving forward and not sideways.
Yeah, I should just say,
Watzinger,
I should just mention, this is Thor Heyerdahl on the expedition of the Kon-Tiki in the movie Kon-Tiki from 1950, but the expedition was a little bit, or some years earlier than 1950, when he was sailing on a raft with his crew from South America to Polynesia. So that's where we're continuing now.
Let's open an asphalt-covered box in order to check its contents. Part of the tests we were carrying out for the U.S. Armed Forces involved two members of the crew abstaining from eating fresh fish, plankton, or any other fresh food we might have on board, and subsisting exclusively on the special diet that was to be tested. They were just as fit and healthy when we reached the journey's end as the other members of the crew, so the diet must have been excellent. Meanwhile, Lorita prefers the contents of the basket on which she likes to perch, coconuts, but she's nonetheless an interested spectator. Watzinger makes copious notes with a view to compiling a detailed report once we reach civilization. Prehistoric man didn't live on army rations, but he had his own resources. The sea with its inexhaustible supply of food would always make up for any lack of supplies on the raft. The fish most in demand was the dolphin fish, also called the bottlenosed dolphin, not to be confused with the dolphin, which is a species of whale, not a fish, but a mammal. This fact was of great importance to my theory. Before we set off, experts maintained that primitive people couldn't possibly make such protracted sea voyages. They would perish for want of fresh food, and no fish could be caught far out in the ocean. Fish, they insisted, were only to be found in the currents that sweep along the coast. This may well be the case if one travels by sea in a boat, which would scare any fish with the noise of its propeller. But drifting slowly and noiselessly across the water on 9 balsa logs, you'll see fish in large numbers, often seeking shelter under the raft. The dolphin fish had a delicious taste, and if we wanted fresh fish for dinner, all we had to do was to drop a hook overboard 20 minutes before the meal. The simplest method was to thrust a pole with a hook at the end of it into the water and give it a tug as soon as you felt the fish bite. The dolphin fish has sharp teeth, and the man climbing onto the crate is taking a very necessary precaution, as he has already had the misfortune to have his big toe in the jaw of one of these large fish.
So, they're continuing on. It's interesting, isn't it, that the dolphin is also a species of fish named dolphin, and not just the mammal, which is the more commonly known dolphin. So there's a different species called the dolphin fish, and that's something I don't recall ever having heard before. Now,
it'll provide not only food, but also drink. One of the experiments we carried out, whenever we landed big fish such as these, was to cut a large hole in the side of the fish. This gradually filled with fluid from the fish's lymph glands, and even though its taste wasn't very good, it could be drunk. It contained such a small percentage of salt that it was a thoroughly effective thirst quencher. When it's a question of life or death, neither white men nor Indians worry much about the taste. There's no doubt whatever that primitive people from Peru were able to survive on board a raft drifting along out to sea in this ocean current. When they sailed their raft along the arid desert coast of Peru, the Indians carried ample supplies of water in large waterproof baskets, in large bottle gourd containers, and further north in thick hollow bamboo canes. We carried not more than a ton of water, and this proved more than enough for the entire journey. After a while, we came to an area where there were frequent showers, and this gave us enough fresh water to keep going. Following advice received from the Royal Air Force, we also carried out another experiment. On really warm days, when the pores secreted a lot of salt, we mixed seawater with our drinking water. On occasion, we'd mix as much as 40% seawater with 60% fresh water, and quench our thirst without any harmful consequences. We also collected parasites from the fish we caught and preserved them in bottles. The sea also contained lots of other smaller organisms that we collected and ate, namely plankton, tiny creatures and plants almost invisible to the naked eye, floating around, on, and under the surface of the ocean. To collect sufficient quantities, we simply used a fine mesh net which was towed astern. When hauled in, our catch resembled a colorful gruel or porridge which tasted, according to which species we had caught, like shrimps, roe, or oysters. Occasionally, this would contain something resembling a jellyfish, forming an unappetizing scum which had to be removed. But in every respect, plankton proved highly nourishing. After all, the largest whales live on a diet of plankton. The masthead lookout has caught sight of some large creature emerging from the depths of the sea. Quite right, it's a large whale. We were often visited by these leviathans. The first time a whole school or pod of these air-breathing creatures circled around our craft, we were rather scared. To start with, they kept a respectable distance, but not for long. Soon whales were popping up in every conceivable direction, and when they caught sight of the raft with us on board, some of them turned about and made straight for the Contiki. We realized that the largest whales were bigger than the raft, and we were scared of a collision when these huge creatures headed straight for us, and we had no more chance of stopping a whale in its tracks than of stopping this film. A snorting colossus of this kind will weigh several tons, and it was scary to be able to look straight down into their smooth, shiny blowholes. But it would always dive just short of the raft, gliding down into the translucent depths below our floating living room. Time and again, we could perch on the edge of the Contiki and look down on the broad, bluish-black back of a whale lying almost motionless in the clear water below. We knew that the whales often attack small boats, either crushing them or capsizing them with a mighty blow of their tail. But no whale ever threatened the Contiki. One might make straight for us at great speed, but would always dive in the nick of time. When the whales tired of frolicking around the raft, they'd disappear as suddenly as they had appeared. After one of these visits, we usually checked the lashings. They often broke, but this was not because of the whales. The ropes holding the steering oar in place were constantly in need of repair. The logs in the stern were smooth and slippery, and anyone slipping into the water would be well aware of the many creatures milling around in the sea. By day, there would always be someone at hand to come to one's rescue, but at night, the man on the helm would be on his own. At regular intervals, we made a complete inspection of all the rope lashings. We carried spare lengths of rope, but only enough for a few logs if all the ropes disintegrated. But the experts had been quite wrong when they maintained that the ropes on a balsa raft would be chafed right through. As it turned out, the logs had no effect on the lashings, and the secret was quite simply that balsa is as soft and pliable as cork. The ropes, being harder than balsa, would dig deeper and deeper into the logs until they were completely protected in deep grooves. The radio operators had no easy task. The transmitter had to be watertight, and besides, there was not enough room on the raft to rig an aerial of any length. Robbie solved this problem by making a balloon. Our parrot was particularly interested in radio. Here she is seen closely watching Robbie's experiment, producing hydrogen for his balloon by mixing a special powder with seawater. Once the balloon is big enough, all Robbie has to do is to attach it to one end of his aerial, send it aloft, and get just the right length of aerial. All went well until the parrot decided to bite through the aerial wire, ensuring that the balloon went even higher. The radio operator had his set in a corner of the bamboo hut. With a transmitting strength of 7 watts, direct contact was made with a radio ham in Norway at the opposite end of the world. This in itself was a sort of world record. Here contact has just been made with a radio ham in Los Angeles, who had picked up our message announcing that we are halfway across the Pacific. This means that after 45 days, we'd already covered a distance more than that between Oslo and the North Pole, which meant that we had exactly one half of our voyage left.
Okay. So we're just about at the 30-minute mark, 29 minutes, 33 seconds. So we can stop there for today, I believe. And that's quite interesting, isn't it, to see how advanced these sailors were, technologically advanced with their radio equipment, and they seem to be quite knowledgeable about how to keep the proper salt content in the body by drinking a mixture of seawater with water when they needed salt. It was quite an informative group, or an informative documentary movie, I think, to you could learn a lot from that. And that's, it's like a lot of people don't know, for example, that to do with radioactivity, it's very true that plutonium, if you breathe it in, is very deadly because it causes cancer over the long term once it lodges in the lung. But if you eat a tablespoon of plutonium, that's believed to be quite safe compared to breathing it in. So, and even though plutonium is very highly poisonous, if you're just eating it and it's going through your digestive tract, it's far less harmful. In fact, considered to be essentially harmless, which, of course, most people don't know. And we wouldn't recommend eating plutonium anyway. But that's just a very simple fact that everybody who worked at Atomic Energy knew about, because we were educated in the details of radioactive fission products, which came out of the reactors, which were so dangerous, of course, if you did breathe them in. And that's why, you know, proper air filtration respirators were so important in the event of some kind of accident where some of this radioactive fission product could be released. So So we're talking about the Ark of Noah, though. There was no nuclear radioactivity, nothing like that. The other point, too, about nuclear is it's often mispronounced by some people, but it's nuclear. Nuclear is the proper pronunciation of that word, and the spelling indicates that also. The Hebrew word we're going to come to tomorrow, we're going to talk about Nisir, what it means in Hebrew, because the Ark ended up on Mount Nisir in the Gilgamesh epic, which was a Sumerian legend or story, actually. We know it. Actually, we know the epic of Gilgamesh was quite replete with facts and things that were true, because it compares well with the Bible account, and in fact it compares with the actual evidence of the remains of Noah's Ark, which we've been discussing. So, you know, these fascinating historical documents are important in addition to the archaeological work of the faithful people who worked on the site in Turkey, called the Drupanar site, after the name of the man who was the military officer on board the aircraft that discovered the boat-like object shape on the survey photograph, you know, that was obtained by flying over the area in around the time period 1959, I believe, and it was not ever seen prior to that in the modern day. So this discovery of the Ark site, and here it was very significant, and it led to the confirmation of the whole story of Noah's Ark, with the dimensions of the boat being correct and everything, as we've just seen. And there's so much that can be done, and we can continue to study this for a long time if anyone's interested. We also have this picture here of the Urartian pitchfork, just kind of a note there. Let's end for today. It's September 7th, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 1322 hours North American Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. Thank you for listening and watching. And on my behalf, this is Liv Dusty. This is Cassie saying bye for now. And we've been studying the Ark of Urartu, the Orient Express, Chapter 1, Paragraph 5 today. And it's quite a story about the Ark, isn't it? I mean, remarkable. I think some people would be in agreement with that. So bye for now.